Buttheads, welcome back to Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. My name is Richard.
And I am Kyle. Richard, welcome.
Hey, welcome to you too, Kyle.
Yeah, I'm welcoming you this time. I'm flipping things around.
It feels really, really good.
I'm changing up energies.
Feels really, really good. Happy Saturday morning. I guess afternoon now.
Something.
The Witches, Zemeckis' Witches just got released, and we both watched it. And
we did.
A special pod that where we're skipping over a whole bunch of films to tackle this one and give some hot takes.
Hot takes.
Very, 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 very hot. Well, I guess I'll dive right in. I watched it twice.
Oh, did you? All right, excellent.
I did. I watched it again last night.
I watched the original Witches and then the new one back to back, one on one night, and then watched the Bob Z the Witches the next night.
The first time I watched it, I was a little disappointed. It wasn't the movie I wanted it to be. And the second time I watched it, I warmed to it much, much more and accepted it for what it is and had a lot more fun with it. And I think you and I texted back and forth, and I was just like, oh, man, it just wasn't what I thought it was good, what I hoped it would be. It wasn't what I hoped it would be.
Well, let me know
what you were expecting it to be.
What were you expecting it to be when we start out with that?
I don't know. I think it's not about expectation. I think it was about what I hoped it would be. I wanted it to be this thing that just like slaps everybody in the face and says the guy's absolutely still got it. And the reaction online was definitely not that. And
yeah,
my initial viewing
gives a shit about that.
Totally, totally. That's kind of how I felt watching it too. Is like it wasn't the thing that was like, ah, there it is. He's still the guy that he was.
I think
that was more the thing, kind of I had to get past that hope, to be like, what is the movie actually doing well, and what are the really fun parts of the movie? Because I had like made a whole bunch of notes about the things that I liked, and I was shocked at how many things I was writing down after that first viewing, which is why I watched it a second time. I was like, I actually liked a whole lot of this. Why did I have this like feeling that it didn't deliver for me? Because I think ultimately it did. But how did you react to it?
I really liked it. I really liked it a lot. It was interesting to kind of see it come out now. To see it come out in this moment, because I feel like it feels delightful and magical in a way that I think I anticipate is going to connect with people a lot more in the weird world that we currently live in. I'm curious to pay attention, and I realize that these things are hard to track these days, but I'm curious to follow up because I have a feeling it will really catch on with people who want something. I don't know, obviously Hocus Pocus has caught on more in recent years. People are I was just talking to some friends who are watching a lot more sort of goofy, silly horror right now, saying the sort of bleak horror that's been made in recent years just for some reason isn't slapping in quite the way they had hoped now that the world itself is quite bleak. So I actually quite enjoyed first of all, to give some context, huge fan of the original Witches, used to watch it. The Nicholas Rogue movie. Watched it on VHS a million times when I was a kid. Revisited it again the night before. And so there's certain things going in that I know that are core to why I like the Nicholas Rogue movie, the original film, that are just not going to be present in this film. Like, obviously a huge component for why, you know, in my mind, up till this point, something that's hard to separate from my appreciation for the movie, which is it's interesting because now having seen this remake, it actually enables me to appreciate other dimensions. But when the first thing you think of when you think of the Witches is Jim Henson. I think it was the last movie he actually worked on in an official capacity before his death or something like that. But anyway, it's a Jim Henson Creature Shop movie. What I love about Jim Henson Creature Shop creations is that they are very surreal and out there and crazy. And certainly The Witch is one of those movies you point to kind of typifies that, mainly the Grand High Witch, the reveal of the big makeup, all of the incredible little puppets of the mice and everything. It's really fantastic. And then in addition to that, I mean, again, and as was confirmed as I revisited it again recently, I watch it pretty regularly, so it hadn't been that long, but looking at it with new eyes, that it is also a terrifying and disturbingly real and weird film for kids. And you know, and so you have that layer, and then that way, there's a tremendous synergy between the Jim Henson Creature Shop creations and the tone of the film itself, in the sense that, like, not unlike The Storyteller, which was another great Henson thing, you know, with John Hurt. Great show. If you haven't seen The Storyteller, check it out. A lot of cool creations. But there's a kind of there is a fairy-like quality, a dreamlike quality to the clearly preposterous proportions of the witch's face and many of the creatures in The Storyteller, and that is very, very appealing just to me personally, and I think is something that we really do not see much of in creature design. One of the things that we've talked about it a bunch, that now every creature in every movie, to say nothing of the fact that they're rendered entirely in CGI, they also always have no eyes, and like if it's a witch, it has to look like some, you know, creepypasta online dark eye spooky face version, which generally negates any kind of personality or whimsy that could play off of, let's say, a menacing witch character. No, it just the gif has to look scary, and so you don't get creative or interesting or dynamic designs. You just get spooky creepypasta faces over and over and over again, you know. And those movies abound. So you know going into this remake that, okay, so the appreciation I have for, to touch one more thing on the tone of the original witches, that's why that I just think that Nicholas Rogue just shooting these things in like this weird, creepy, like wide-angle lens documentary style. He's coming out of the 70s. He worked with Bowie. He's just, you know, it's like, there's, I'm not the first person to observe this, but there's like a real creepy, and obviously the opening sequence with the painting is fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
And then even how it's handled, showing the police show up to the house and like handheld documentary feel, it feels more like an episode of Law & Order SVU than it does a children's movie at that point. And then the movie keeps punishing that boy the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, they hired him to make a horror film. That's what it is.
Yeah, that is absolutely what it is. And, that's part of why that thing works. So it's interesting to even go into this film, and I kind of assumed, because it's 2020 and because it's Robert Zemeckis, that probably we're not going to be getting a lot of practical effects. Now, again, people tend to people like sound bites, and they tend to quickly equate entire movies to single things. And like, the practical effects are why we like The Witches. No, we like The Witches for a lot of reasons, you know, so you can still remove the practical effects, and we'll see what's there. So going in, we know, okay, and then clearly the first trailer shows us we got a bunch of CGI mice, we got CGI Anne Hathaway,
faces,
you know,
CGI,
looking like
CGI
Melina
faces
from Mortal Kombat 2, you know, and with her big face and whatnot.
Well, I was thinking Fright Night. I thought Fright Night.
Oh, Fright Night, yes, perfect example. Yeah, even better, and which I just revisited the other night. It was great.
Which is also great.
Yes, it's another one of my favorite movies. Yeah, I showed that one to Taylor as well for the first time, and she loved it because, of course, she did.
Mm-hmm. Hard not to love Fright Night.
Hard not to love Fright Night. But going into this thing, I was very curious because I love the movie, and what I was immediately taken with in the first third was like, oh yeah, it's a Robert Zemeckis movie. He can do stuff good. all the stuff with the kid and the ma or the grandma, and especially the death of the parents, and
so good
how the film, instead of, and it honestly has always struck me when watching the original Witches, how, you know, and this is not a problem with the original Witches, but it's just because of, it's a heightened fairy story, it kind of has to blow past all this insane trauma that's being dropped on the kid's head. Instead, okay, maybe rather than leaning against or really in, they lean into that in this film, and they utilize the idea that, well, probably a kid losing his parents would be the main thing going on in his life there on after, and it uses pulling him out of that to be this thing that sort of starts to bond and really define the relationship between him and his grandmother, which I thought was not just a good idea, but also really well done, and also worked for me in terms of really making me empathize, not just for them individually, but empathize, like want that relationship, them as a unit, to succeed, which is critical
for
where
later
the film goes later on.
Totally.
But then in addition to all that, it's funny and it's good, and like there's, and how he wonderfully sets up that frame for her to come running back in with the singing the song.
I know, I love it.
and you have that class. We talked about it on a previous episode. Those first 6 minutes of a Robert Zemeckis movie or so always have just so much packed in cinematically, visually, and that shot of the car accident, which starts with the snow going upside down. Again, we've gone through what? The looking glass, you know? Now we are in the inverted world. Snow doesn't go down, it goes up. We basically...
His life is literally turned upside down.
His life is literally turned upside down. He literally crosses the other side of the mirror, and then we reveal in that spiraling shot backwards that he's hung, and by what? His seatbelt, the one thing that saved him. Delicious. And then we see all the broken glass there.
And his father's glasses. His father's glasses.
Exactly. He's looking through glass. Again, all this stuff to tell us that we're going through the looking glass. Of course, now his life was one way before. Now it is this inverted magical world on the other side. And it's all told visually, and it's just fucking gorgeous. And then after that, he just goes on to it's just good to see character stuff done good in a movie.
That was one of the things that I, looking back on the movie, I was kind of shocked at how emotionally invested I was. Like when Octavia Spencer shows up on screen and the look on her face when she sees the boy just kind of sitting huddled, like broken and limp. Just her performance there, like that hit me. Like, and I was tearing up when that happened. And it was
It's a good example of we talk about kind of the difference between, you know, movies and the language of movies and like the language of the rolling Netflix series. And there seems to be a lot of debate and like, are they different? Are they the same medium? Essentially, and they are. But that's just one of those things. Like how much time it spent, and well spent time, even without words and visually establishing that relationship. Just look at the boy's posture and how all of those shots of him hunched into those various couches and everything did so much to kind of make him seem broken. And again, it's the kind of thing, and then because that is being done with the boy's posture and with the setting, then the dialogue can become buoyant as it is freed from the burden of having to tell us about his feelings. Now it can be all this stuff about cornbread and about music and about all of this other shit that plays off of that. And instead, and now again, just let's go to the other side of the looking glass where the rest of us live, where we have to watch a bunch of Netflix series these days, and how would that same beat be executed? He would talk to first someone about, he would talk to a police officer for about 7 minutes, then he would talk to a social worker for 7 minutes, then a therapist for 7 minutes, and we would have heard about, he would have had about 9 minutes of words by this point, and then they would have to do a rewrite. How do we get some jokes in there? I don't know, this feels very tough, and then they would be trying to, then it's long, so then you got to start cutting shit out, and then you have a Frankenstein opening scene of a movie. And it's just, it's a nice thing to, again, it starts to, it's pulling into more and more kind of hot relief the more you sort of, especially when watching a lot of older movies after, during quarantine and everything, in lockdown, as opposed to watching a lot of like Netflix stuff before. It's like, oh, right, this was a different language. And then honestly, a language that is just more conducive to a visual medium, because then the scenes can kind of take off and they're lighter and they're a little bit freer. And they're not just about people explaining what someone else explained in the previous scene and what someone else is going to explain in the scene that's about to happen.
Right. And even like I watched the Old Witches last night too, before the rewatch, and the giving of the mice suddenly has the mouse has so much more impact in the Zemeckis version, as it is the thing that she does for him. After trying several different things to kind of bring him back to life, it's the mice that bring him suddenly back to life, and where he begins to start to feel human again.
Yes, no, exactly, and that suddenly had a level of significance to it. That's true. I was trying to think somehow. Then it was the naming of she gets him to name
Daisy.
The thing. Yeah, naming of the mouse Daisy, and then all of that stuff. And of course, what happens at the moment he decides. Again, classic Zemeckis imagery here, Richard. What happens at the exact moment that he decides to name the mouse Daisy, thereby connect with his grandmother? She pours water over his
baptizes
head.
Baptizes it. Oh,
exactly.
It's very
she
religious.
Baptizes him. No, but what does that mean? What does that mean? We talk about that cinema isn't sort of inherently spiritual medium. medium. So like, what does that mean? It means that his spirit, his soul, you know, the family, mm-hmm. the home, which had been so broken before, is now being restored to him by showing this sort of spiritual life being poured back into him through something so simple as her putting the mouse in his room and asking him to name it. So, and she's like, think on that, or some line like that, just something to get his mind
and she gives
going
him,
in a creative way.
And she gives him shit about the name too. She mm-hmm. She gives him shit of, oh, Lazy, that's a terrible name for that mouse. That mouse just keeps running. No, Daisy. Which is a great little moment where you get you feel great. Like we've all had adults do that to us, where
she's trying to draw him out.
Yeah, and draw him out.
I
do one of the things, isn't this is just a small thing, all of the food in this movie looked really tasty. Like the shot of that fried chicken and the cornbread, like,
dude,
it was so pleasing.
We were at home, and I said out loud, I was watching it. Of course, I was watching with Cliff and Taylor, and I was like, oh, man, that fried chicken. He was like, yeah, immediately, because, well, Cliff loves fried chicken. We know this.
But, and it looked good, and the cornbread looked good, too.
And so
it was very pleasing. I love that moment when she's like, you know, cornbread's basically cake. You like cake, don't you?
Yeah.
And he slowly takes that is a huge slice of cornbread, too. Like, I want to eat that. And it felt very, it's comfort food. It felt very comforting looking at it.
Yes. Everything about that, it's interesting because, you know, about a third of the way in, I'm trying to think of, about a third of the way in, I was so on board with everything. I'm trying to think that when the first disjunction happened for me, I think was the moment when they encountered the first witch, and we had that very far out performance style where she's, you know, and which I
she's
click
raspy,
is derived from the book of the voice being the
like a creaking door,
which actually kind of came to really dig. But then that is combined. We're sort of confronted with that, and we're trying to process that, and then all of a sudden a CGI snake shows up in a movie that hasn't really had any creatures like that, and it does stand out. Now here's the thing. I am also aware of this fact, and I think that this is a relevant thing to talk about because it's relevant to why we're discussing this. We're kind of discussing this out of sequence. We've made it, I guess, through Roger Rabbit at this point. We really haven't. I have not recently revisited any of the CG laden.
Neither have I.
Zemeckis-y stuff, but obviously a lot of the criticisms of those films, especially like, you know, Polar Express and everything or whatever, is that the, you know, there's a textural aspect to the films that people throw around the phrase Uncanny Valley a lot, that means that the CGI itself somehow takes people out of the movie or whatever. So I'm not picking necessarily on special effects when I talk about this, but it's like, okay, it's a Zemeckis movie, it has a lot of CGI.
It's going
clearly
to have it.
Even, obviously, The Grand High Witch, done all with, you know, computers and whatnot now, as opposed to
Which we should talk about. But this
kind of sits in a larger discussion about like the nature of CGI as kind of a storytelling tool, because I think there is a difference between whether or not CGI or animation is well done, and whether it was one issue, and whether or not it necessarily fits whatever the prevailing aesthetic texture of the time or the fashion of the era or whatever. And that's true of all special effects, and that's true of every aspect from screenwriting to production design to directing styles to everything. And like we were talking about before, the Jim Henson's Creature Shop, for instance, you know, that was an aesthetic that really didn't necessarily win the day moving forward into the late 90s and the 2000s. Things got much, like, creatures were far less whimsical and have become far, far, far more realistic and far more, you know, boring is, the word I'm looking for. And I was thinking when watching Zemeckis's choices here with the CGI, which are very bold, but I realized watching this, I became aware that, oh, this is definitely, and I haven't looked at any criticism surrounding the film at all, but I'm assuming that probably people say Zemeckis, therefore CGI, and they'll probably harp on CGI sticking out as an element. And yet I cannot help but feel that that is something that will become, and not just with this movie, but with all movies, increasingly irrelevant over time, because I think that so much of what we respond to when we say, quote unquote, bad CGI, yes, there's plenty of really poorly executed CGI in the world, but I don't really think that is true of of this film because, no. And I'm making it to a long, very long-winded point here, which is what struck me as sort of a bit silly when I first saw it in the trailer, struck me as working in context beautifully, mm-hmm. because you see that the CGI is a reflection of this whimsical world. It reflects
the tone. It reflects beautifully the tone that he's doing with everything else. It just
and it's not effects. It's the design
style.
Choices that he is making. Many of these design choices that he is making with these things reflect the world that he has built. And it's like if you then throw in a biomechanical witch with no eyes or whatever the fuck they're doing in spooky house movies these days. It doesn't quite work. And what's amazing, that's an obvious statement. Yeah. Of course, that doesn't work. But what I found was I expected, because the special effects, because the practical effects were such a huge component of my love of the first film, I expected my mind to fixate on that aspect of it when watching it this time. And it did not at all. That snake occurred, and I was like, maybe just have her pull a fucking snake out of a bag, like was my thought. You know, it's like it seemed to work okay in the first one. Pulled a snake out of a bag, it's fine. Yeah. But then really beyond that, more often I found, especially once we got into the meeting of the witches themselves, I was being quite transported by the crazy shit they were doing with their hands and everything.
100% agree with you. I was kind of shocked that we mentioned it on the, I think on the Tales from the Crypt one, which you'll listen to later, listeners. I was really worried about the mice puppets. I love those mice puppets so much. And that shot of him being transformed in the air, like in the trailer where he turns purple and then shrinks into a mouse. I was like, ooh, man, like, I don't know about this.
I thought of that same, in the trailer it looked a little silly. In context, it's horrifying.
But yeah, it really works. And I really like the mouse designs. I love how the mice look. They fit that kind of cartoony, not quite real, kind of pushed to a cartoon side that's still interacting with the real world. Yeah. And so I was shocked at how much I liked the mice. And first, just speaking about the witches and the design of Anne Hathaway specifically, I was sold on that decision to go full Fright Night with their faces in that flashback that we get to her friend being chickenified, where you get the smoke obscuring her first, and you see it. You see her the kind of obscured element of her mouth, and I was like, that shot is creepy as fuck.
That kind of buys
me enjoying the rest of the thing. And I will say, in terms of how the one thing I really loved about the digital makeup, which I was very skeptical going into the film, is the way her nose works, the her sniffing out.
Oh, the sniffing
him.
Thing.
I loved how that worked.
Well, it's silly, Richard, and you're a big silly man.
And I think that was part of what I was wrestling with. I think the first time is just accepting that the movie is it's a horror film for children. Tonally, that's what it is. So it is doing scary things for kids, but it is also kind of being overtly silly, like with the nose thing, and when she gets her hand smashed, turning and yelling and like a crying like a child, that pulls the child out of this thing. And you remember Kenan and Allison, they have two children now. Allison posted last night with the image of Anne Hathaway holding the sock with the mouse in it, and she posted a picture of that on Instagram last night that just says kids are terrified. And so
that's great, because I agree. I was about to say, as soon as you mentioned that moment, it's like, we should talk about that moment, that was really effective. But anyway, let's before we get into anything, because I feel like our tone sounds kind of metered, because I do have some things I want to point out, especially about the transition into some of the mousy sections. But I just let's talk about something that is incredibly effective. Let's talk about that moment. Now, when he's being lowered down in the sock, I just rewatched the original again, and you're expecting him to be chased by Lipshin. And it's a moment that echoes this moment. Lipshin the cat, who I think has a different name in this.
Precious.
And then, of course, the term, you know, now instead, that moment kind of gets saved for kind of a payoff at the end with the cat, and instead he gets caught by Anne Hathaway. But it's just one of those simple decisions that, you know, that it's entirely a cinematic beat in conception, that you have to hold the mouse and Anne Hathaway's face from that angle, in frame, at the same time, for that mm-hmm. tension to work. And Zemeckis knows that, and he plays the whole scene from that one shot. Now, mm-hmm. today, we would get a little CGI camera that goes inside the sock, and the mouse would, like, duck down, and he'd put a little thimble over his head as his helmet or whatever the thing is. But the moment you would go inside the sock, the relationship, the immediacy of the relationship between the threat and him would be broken, and the tension would release. And instead, Zemeckis just plays it with... And again, let's say that you hate CGI mice, and you decided you never want to see a movie with a CGI mouse. It doesn't matter. That is a cool, tense, effective, mm-hmm. and purely cinematic beat. And I love, 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 love that Allison sent you that picture or posted to Facebook specifically, because I thought that was remarkably effective and delightful, and of mm-hmm. course it scared the shit out of children. They feel like that little mouse hovering above the maw of a monster, and that's what all kids feel like all the time. Right, Richard?
That's definitely what I felt like all the time, and feel like all the time. I still feel that. I want to talk about the transformation sequences, because that was, again, watching that shot in the trailer, I was really worried that mm-hmm. the transformation stuff wasn't going to play. And honestly, I prefer the transformations in the remake. Just the idea of the body shooting up into...
It's not even an issue of preference. It's like there's such different things. It's like...
They are different things, but I prefer the body launching into the air and then it evaporating and clothes flutter, empty clothes fluttering down, mm-hmm. which of course the movie has great fun with.
And by the way, and I also love that. I mean, I also really love like the fucking crazy, weird rat transformations in the original, but, you know, which is its own thing. But what I do like is, again, just a strong choice was made. 10 out of 10 times, you know, 10 out of 10 times, it would turn into, the person would just, the swirl of, you can see it, swirl mm-hmm. of dust, and then they're a mouse. And just, it feels initially, the first time you see it, kind of like a dumb decision, almost like they're propelled by a fart of magic into the air.
Yes.
And then after that, it ends up becoming the fantastic and whimsical fanfare of them all popping at the end. And again, it's just a simple and delightful little choice that had us giggling.
I definitely was laughing at the end. It's very, very, very pleasing at the end.
Yeah, and if again, or my tone seems slightly tempered, it's only because if I have a criticism of the movie, it's that tension of like not quite know, feeling like in some respects, and maybe I'm wrong, I know nothing about the production history of this film, but it feels like on some level like I'm watching the front half or the first half of a movie as conceived, and then some things that have been reworked that don't feel like they quite line up with the front half of the movie
mm-hmm.
In terms of how they're being told, and that's where it began to break down a little. And let me concretize all of that really quickly. The
sure.
moment they transition into the mice, all of a sudden, and maybe this was, it almost had the feeling of a reshoot to me, and I don't, but who knows. But when they first, like the three mice, and they get into the room it's Octavia Spencer who plays that's mm-hmm. the actress's name who plays the mom. Octavia Spencer, they get into the grandma's room, and then there's just a lot for me of just the three mice.
Talking.
Just talking and getting through a bunch of... I do like the part where he's like Gus Gus from Cinderella and he's grabbing all the fat mouse is grabbing all the grapes or whatever.
Also a great
the
shot.
The grape sequence is really good. That grape sequence when the guy comes in is good. Really good.
I thought, and just to speak to that shot specifically mm-hmm. and the one you mentioned with the sock and some other, tons of other shots, I really wish we could have seen this in a theater, because that would read so much better mm-hmm. on a big screen, and all the stuff with Anne Hathaway's face taking up most of the frame, like reaching in. I even thought, like, I would have paid to see this in 3D for that
of
stuff.
Yeah.
And it's kind of disappointing.
Well, no,
while
we're watching that sequence, there's this intricate sequence that is clearly conceptualized and dependent, I'm the kind of person who's like, it's more about seeing a movie with people than the bigness of the screen, and yet the bigness of the screen is clearly a component, because you have an entire play going on between the mice in this tiny little purse at the bottom of the frame mm-hmm. while the actors are going along in the background. And again, I'm watching it on a big TV because we like movies, but a lot of people will probably watch it on a laptop, and honestly, it probably will still play at that scale. I don't know. But
you have to really watch for it. You have to really watch for it on the smaller screen.
That kind of stuff feels very Zemeckis. It feels
very Zemeckis.
Yes, it is cinematic. It is visual. It is playful. It is there to entertain. And then it's like kind of some of the stuff leading up into that, where all of a sudden I found myself disengaging from the movie and drifting. And I think it's like, oh, because it's a lot of talking, which I normally don't mind, but it's a lot of talk. Right, I normally don't mind in certain contexts, but the lot of talking that's coming in is coming from CGI mice, and therefore their expressions and things aren't telling me. And I'm just sort of checking out a little bit. And then there's just other little open-ended things that like, again, when it's revealed, obviously it's a maybe this is how it is in the book, but it's chain, but it's different than it was in the movie.
I can answer
the
mouse, for you.
Okay, well there you go. Well, the mouse Daisy, in fact, isn't just a random mouse, but is in fact a child who.
That's an invention of this movie.
Yeah, okay, well, perfect.
Which
well,
I agree. Is kind
it immediately
of, it's
feels
weird.
Like. Yes, well, the moment that's revealed, I'm like, oh, okay. That tells me that this is definitely going toward the
something
reveal at the
new.
End. Something new, but also it tells me this is definitely going towards the reveal at the end that they are turned from mice back into children. Because in the book, mm-hmm. I guess, the kind of dark ending of the original book, spoilers, I guess, is that the mouse, that he continues to live as a mouse, and then he mm-hmm. dies at the same time as his grandmother 9 years later. I thought something like that.
The movie ends pretty similarly to the book.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that, and I enjoyed how it floats
the idea that they will die at the same time.
Yeah,
the same way as the movie does.
But he stays a mouse is the point. And I immediately thought in that moment that it's like, okay, well, you know, this is clearly leading towards some reveal. She's going to be turned back into a human later on, and we're going to see, and then she's going to kiss the fat kid on the cheek or something like that. That's where we're headed, right? It honestly felt very Monster House in those moments, those CGI moments, when it's like the kid, the fat kid, and the girl kid just shouting in each other's faces and through these CGI golems. But I don't know. God, I've lost my train of thought. What were we just talking about a second ago?
Let me try and pick it up for you. I was excited when the female mouse was mm-hmm. introduced. Like, that was mm-hmm. an exciting moment for me. It was like, oh, they're adding to this story that we've seen and loved, and this is going to be how it starts to differentiate itself. But it kind of... And it positions her as like, I'm not afraid of anything.
Sense where, and I don't, it's like, it doesn't not work in context, but the thing is, it speaks to me of a film that had to be reworked in some way, because it feels like these sequences are built around that mouse having a bigger role, that mouse being turned into back into a human potentially and being revealed to something. Right. And it's like those little things just feel like the scar tissue. Like, it doesn't not work, but it feels like the scar tissue that's left behind. And same thing with, like, they turn into CGI mice, and then all of a sudden Octavia Spencer is in a hotel room, and there's a shot of three CGI mice on a desk, and they're talking us through a bunch of things, and mm-hmm. and the momentum of the movie feels like it's kind of grinding to a halt suddenly. And it just, there feels like there's a little bit of scar tissue for, and again, I could be 100% wrong, but some of those dislocations, it then leads me to believe, do some of those dislocations exist because things had to be reworked versus how much of this is the original vision of either the screenwriter or the director, or is this some best-case scenario version?
I think this was originally Guillermo del Toro's movie. He was going to do it, and then for some reason he stepped away, and then mm-hmm. Zemeckis came in with the creator of the show Black-ish to kind of add their stuff. So there's like a Zemeckis, Kenya Barris, and Guillermo del Toro. So that's mm-hmm. probably what you're picking up. Because I was shocked that they introduced that mouse as this kind of plucky, I'm not scared of anything, and then literally has nothing to do for the rest of the movie, which is very, very, very odd and kind of disappointing.
And very non-Zemeckis.
Right, and you're looking at this, and it's like, well, why isn't this mouse going to help with the kitchen thing, or going to help go get the potion? It would make sense that there would be two of them to help do this thing, especially now that we have a capable second mouse. Mm-hmm. So we have this capable second mouse that does nothing except for hide in a purse after she goes and saves the fat mouse.
And that's the sort of thing where. It's like the little scar tissue things that like look like they're from previous versions of the movie or whatever don't necessarily bother me in themselves, but then certain aspects. For some reason, I would have probably have to watch it a second time to tell you why. Once it was kind of an interesting inversion from the original film, where the original film, the moment the mice puppets show up,
it's like, yes.
It feels like the film picks up in energy. And I noticed that the other night. We've seen all this great stuff with Angelica Houston, and we've seen all the witches and everything. But at a certain point, we're kind of getting sick and tired of looking at these two ugly kids. And they are ugly kids, let's be honest. Both the kids in The Witches are not attractive. They're not attractive kids, Richard. Especially that whiny British kid. He is just, ugh. It is hard to look at him.
He's nails on chalkboard.
And so when he gets turned into a mouse, we're like, yay, I don't have to look at him anymore. And then a moment later, we're like, God, I still have to look at this kid, though, the kid from Parenthood. But then they turn him into an adorable Jim Henson puppet as well. And you're like, score, I get it now. These kids have cool voices. I'm glad I don't have to look at them anymore and instead get to look at these puppets. And instead, with this film, and honestly, if he hadn't done such a good fucking job in the first third of the film, maybe it wouldn't have been an issue. But the moment the kid disappeared and there was a CGI mouse, I was like, can you bring the kid back? He was rad. Like, I cared about him in a way I never cared about the other. That's not true. I do care about Luke in the other film, but Luke's just aesthetically unpleasant to look at or hear at any point. He's much better as a mouse. He's better as a Jim Henson mouse. And unfortunately, anyone is better as themselves than necessarily a CGI mouse.
And I don't necessarily share that.
I don't
the kids.
Necessarily
in the new
either.
One,
I'm just saying
in the kids in the new one. I agree that the movie starts to flag, and that's just getting out all the stuff that the book has to get out in the very similar way with the mice talking. But I like the kid's performance as a mouse. I thought all the mouse action stuff in the back half of the film, I really responded to in a big way, and I really like the kid's energy and performance as a mouse almost better than his performance as the grieving child.
And I'm not even saying it's all necessarily the kid or the one actor versus the other.
Totally.
But all kidding aside, but it's instead just the idea that I cared about a tangible human story that was going on, and then all of a sudden those characters disappeared, and then I was watching an animated film versus somehow the movie with the puppets feels like it increases in its magicalness the moment we switch to the puppets. But that being said, I did not then check out. Clearly, we were just talking about the fact that by the time we make it to some really fantastic sequences like the spooky bit with her grabbing the sock, holding the bottom of it, all that stuff, really cool stuff. And I re-engaged with the movie, and by the end of it, I quite liked it, but I did note that on at least the one viewing I've had through was at precisely the moment where the other movie really picks up for me, and I'm just, or like it gets energy from that mouse transition, this one sort of seems to kind of push me back and then ask me to kind of slowly reinvest. So
I kind of agree with you. I found the mouse action stuff awesome, but was kind of like, with this movie's kind of dragging in between the mouse action beats, and they just kind of feel a bit, those moments feel a bit ham-fisted and not done.
It's not even so much. I don't think anything's badly done. I actually think it's all really well executed. I think it's, when I say that things lose their energy, what I mean is like there's a tension to seeing a real mouse, like because a lot of the stuff is also done with real mice, not just puppets in the original film. There's a kind of tension to seeing a real mouse go along a CGI, or sorry, go along a real
with real feet. Real feet, real place, the mouse
run down a real
around.
Spoon, go over real mouse above real boiler. And then it's not even so much that the stuff is real, but it has a texture of reality to it. On the other end, because obviously this all looks a lot like Ratatouille, you know, you have the whimsical animated film Ratatouille, and then again, we slice this interesting line in some sort of uncanny valley, if you will, Richard, where the CGI mouse above the CGI pot in a live-action movie just isn't connecting for me in some way. I noticed especially there was this one shot where he runs along above the pots, and I remember how delightful it was watching the mouse in the original. I'm also a big fan of Mouse Hunt. Remember the movie Mouse Hunt?
I do.
Mouse running around?
I do.
Part of what makes that movie rad is they have a little mouse running around, and you're like, look at him go. You know?
Yeah.
They say never work with animals or children, except when it's a little mouse, and he's the only one on screen, and he can execute little stunts.
And you have a Jim Henson Creature Shop puppet that's waiting in the wings for you to do the close-ups. Yeah,
exactly. Witches understood this, Richard. Mouse Hunt understood this. You know, you got to have a little mouse in there. And so it's the kind of thing where I am sure, and again, I also have to realize that I am probably not the age of this film's target audience, which is not necessarily a criticism of the movie, in that I think that those kids will be able to invest in that mouse and identify with it much stronger than I can. But for me, that disconnect happens
and
at that
point. I was kind of transported into that children's mindset, though, with the way the sweeping camera moves. Zemeckis moves the camera very big across in a way that you couldn't do with real mice. And the mice are so small and packed in the frame when those things are happening that they don't feel like CGI mice to me. It just feels like this crazy, sweeping, magical, big cinematic beat, which lands then on CGI mouse faces, which again, I was surprised at how that really didn't bother me at all. I think the things that stood out were like the reason I kind of had a reaction on first viewing was the fact that they set up that mouse and then don't do anything with her. They set up that they're in the South in the late 60s and it's a black family, and they go to the swanky hotel and then don't really do anything with it.
I think they do stuff with it, but go ahead.
They do very small things, but I don't feel like the movie pays off any of that work in the front half. And that was
I disagree because I think that we might be talking about like a contemporary mode of storytelling that we would normally expect in a movie like this, which is very literal in nature versus a cinematic form of storytelling. Because I do think they do pay all that stuff off in very interesting ways, like the scene where Anne Hathaway opens the chest full of money and she's has all of this money and she is disgusted by it, which I thought was a wonderful, 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 one of the more brilliant touches in this script. Was as she's pulling off these dollar bills, she's as disgusted by them as she is disgusted by children. And that says a lot about what the both being disgusted by children and what all of the rest of the design elements and choices in the film mean, and imbue it with a lot more meaning, especially in relation to how that is handled in the first part of the film, because it makes it about class. It makes it about haves and have-nots, but it makes it about it in a very interesting way that I'm not even sure. I would probably have to revisit the film again to actually fully, like, to fully sound super smart about it, Richard. But I'll do my best.
You're doing fine.
But it's really interesting because it immediately the witches, which previously were just mean lady like spinsters who are angry and don't like kids or whatever it's supposed to mean. The witches are given a different meaning in this.
Well,
now,
what they actually were supposed to mean, the Roald Dahl was apparently an avowed anti-Semite.
Okay, well, there you go. But looking at it in this concept, but what are they supposed to mean in this context? It makes it about class. It makes it about essentially there being those who are disgusted by the material and disgusted by those who are below them. It makes it about class. We have an iconic association with the idea of a rich person who hates their own wealth or doesn't like talking about money or just doesn't understand the things they take for granted, yada, 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 which is quite different, by the way, just to bring it back to that and interesting to bring up the whole anti-Semitism thing. If we can't put this on YouTube now, we'll get demonetized for saying that word, Richard. All of this cash flow we're getting from this podcast will evaporate.
Enormous cash flow. Just safes full of money.
But it's like, are they portrayed as being greedy? Are they portrayed as coveting goods? No, quite the opposite. They're portrayed as people who are kind of disgusted by the fact that they have to engage with the material world, that they're disgusted by people who reproduce. They very much feel like a more contemporary idea of the kind of disgust we have for sort of an elite and wealthy cultural class that sort of looks down upon... I'm trying to slice a very specific line here because it's more so than just it being about haves and have-nots. It's instead about the idea that that we have everything, you don't have anything, but we just don't like to talk about that or address it, or it's not part of the text of the thing. Like, even the money itself, it would be an easy way to make the witches seem more evil, to make them want money, to make them greedy after that, but to instead have their motivations not just be sort of amaterial, but in a sense anti-material, is an interesting choice, because it's an idea that almost wouldn't make sense as a way of portraying a rich person in a kind of potent way as in any other moment than now, when some of these issues have become so potent and angry. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just, it's something I want to see again, just to sort of see that I enjoyed that moment specifically because we're attaching the idea of what this particular brand of class war and things mean. Like when Stanley Tucci brings him in, obviously,
yeah,
he doesn't make a racist comment. He doesn't say anything. But what he does do is he said, well, it's such a rare opportunity for a boy like you to stay in this hotel. That this is about, you know, that this is about class. And it is about one class trying to hold on to their power over another class and all sorts of wonderful things like that. And it's very interesting.
I think for me, it was not so much a class thing, but a race thing where it kind of sets up. It felt to me like it was going to go in a direction and engage with it in a meaningful way as the film developed. And then I didn't feel that it did that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that and the female mouse getting put aside. And one more thing. And the third
go
thing
ahead,
and the third thing that just kind of felt like it lost steam on that. I think it's just, I wanted the film to engage more with that idea that it seems to set up, the female mouse, the race in the South, and also, her having magic, like weird voodoo magical powers. I was like, when that gets introduced, I'm like, ooh, this could be really cool. And then it's kind of just one little sequence where she pours some things into a bowl, and that's kind of the end of it. I wanted more. I dug it too. And I think I just wanted it to go further, and I wanted it to have more things. And the fact that it didn't kind of
separate point, by the way, we'll talk about the ways in which magic is introduced into the movie, specifically the numerology surrounding their room number and all the other stuff, which the magic stuff with the grandmother is in there in interesting ways. But to kind of just to touch on, what was the thing we were just wrapping up? Oh, yes, the witches and the money and the class thing.
Yeah.
I disagree, and I definitely disagree that it's not addressed again. And I disagree with the idea that it's addressed addressed insufficiently. I think it's addressed actually in a wonderful way. I think it's addressed in a purely subtextual way, in the sense everything we were talking about, the boy's posture in the opening of the thing, you know, his posture sells everything visually, whatever, not just his posture, but we'll use that as a shorthand. His posture sells the idea. So the dialogue or the textual elements, the literal elements of the film, therefore can float above that. Now, do you want to literalize, if you want to literalize the issue, especially if you want to literalize the issue of race in a kid's movie, it's, again, I'll use the metaphor, it's a classic writing metaphor, but you throw a large pond into a stone full of ripples and like it will, you know, overtake everything. Like it's a choice. You could literalize the race issue, and it is literalized a couple of times, but you only need it the once. As Steve Martin once said, you only need like one cultural commentary joke. I think this was in his master class, and an entire act for everyone to say, this guy is a smart social commentator. It doesn't have to be every joke. And what that affords them the ability to do is, again, allow that to be told visually and how obviously coded all of the iconography around the kid being a black kid in the South and what that means with him going to a hotel full of white people. Like, it is all there. We don't have to talk. It's all clearly there, and it becomes more potent the more it is communicated visually and the less in which it is literalized. It actually becomes more effective, I believe.
I'm not saying that the movie doesn't have the elements present and doesn't try to pay them off. I'm saying that it felt like it was ramping up to something and then lost steam with it. That's what I'm saying. And that's just personal feeling on it going through. And that's with the voodoo stuff, and that's with the female mice thing mouse thing. And it was, I think it was those three things that kind of made me step back and disengage a little bit from the film. And that's why I rewatched it. Now, knowing that it was not going to be hyper literal and continue to build on all these things, even though I feel like they're a detriment to the film, like knowing how it was going to engage with them and start to finish, I found it much, much easier to enjoy the film and warm to it and have fun with all of the things that it's doing. I just wanted it. It's not me saying it's right or wrong. I just personally wanted it to go go further and give me a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, and I do not doubt that doing that would have made the film maybe have better reviews than it. I don't know if it's having good reviews or not, but I disagree. I fundamentally don't. I just disagree with that mode of storytelling, which is, again, if this were a Netflix series, they would have all the time in the world to talk and talk and talk about all of the material things that they want to concretize. But the kind of symbolic nature of the thing, the fact that it's all loaded in there visually, is, I believe, sort of innately a more cinematic approach to these things. It's like the film is not subtle in its imagery. Like, it's definitely not that. And you know what? You know what? It definitely didn't need a producer coming in and saying, I don't know, it's only in the pictures. They should talk about this more. And just in case, and I don't even remember what the joke was, but they do, she makes a joke, says some comment about him being like, well, he's a little black boy in a hotel full of, something like that. I forget what it is. She says something like that. So it is addressed textually at some point.
I don't remember the line.
Yeah, it's somewhere in there, but so it is addressed textually, but that's what, that kind of restraint, I don't know, to me is interesting because it allows so much of everyone's identification, everyone's empathy, everyone to flow through the movie effortlessly, and then slyly let you know at the same time sort of where these, it allows the characters to do all of the lifting through their actions rather than through a bunch of talking, Richard. A bunch of talking.
Well, I mean, the argument for what you're saying, I think, is suddenly when he becomes a mouse, he's the brightest and happiest he's ever been because he doesn't have to deal with any of these other being a small black child in the South. And maybe that was the thing. Or
everyone would be happier as mice.
Or that's just a, like, the big thematic thrust of the movie is, well, sometimes life is hard and throws you a shit sandwich and you have to eat it. And it's how you deal with eating that shit sandwich. And when he's turned into a mouse, it seems to, like, it takes the weight off his shoulders of grieving for his parents in a way. Burden is released when he has the thing and he's excited in a very dark and weird way that he's going to die at the same time as his elderly grandmother. He relishes it.
And that's where the decision and the issues of them dying and everything are the ending specifically become relevant. They don't become kind of just dark and whimsical and spooky, but become relevant because it's about mortality. He's dealing with the death of his parents in the beginning. There is a loss of innocence. There's a snake that shows up relatively early in the film, but there's a loss of innocence. There is this confrontation with death, and obviously there's a lot of symbolism with, you know, the loss of innocence being the awareness of your own mortality often comes when a pet, or in this case, you know, the kid's parents die. This literally, his entire world inverts. He's upside down. Snow goes up. Shattered glass. Glasses going through the looking glass. All that shit. And yet the mouse is innately tied with its short lifespan now to the idea of death. To the boy, like, not just learning not to fear this death that is 70 years away when he is an old man, and they even give him the voice of an old man with Chris Rock definitely playing up his oldness, and ultimately he's revealed to be gray and all of that. And you see that he is happy with his short lifespan, with what the actions he has performed and the nature of his life, and that he is now, instead of being paralyzed and afraid of death, and it's, again, not about the character getting over a literal fear of death. You don't need to have him like, I'm afraid to go outside because the witches are going to get me. It's about him reckoning with his own mortality, the loss of his parents, and then eventually coming to find a happy life that is only like 9 or 10 years. I think it's 9 years long or whatever in the movie, and thereby saying that ultimately it doesn't matter how much time you have; it's what you do with it.
Yeah, and because he has at the end of the movie, he has purpose. It's to go kill the witches.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that all tracks. But there was one line. There was one. It really does. And there's one line that I want to call attention to because it was in the original movie, and it's in the book. And rewatching the second time, it struck me how there's in talking about depth of what's happening on screen. It's like the mouse, him as a mouse, is saying how great it is. Like, don't worry, Grandma, it's fine. I actually love being a mouse. It's great. Mm-hmm. I never have to learn how to drive, which is told in such a buoyant tone.
I never have to grow up.
But that, and just the fact that him saying he doesn't have to drive, when we opened the movie with him grieving 15 minutes of screen time, mm-hmm. with his parents having been killed in a car accident. And so that line, just thinking about some of the depth that definitely is in there. That line is said so buoyantly, but has so much like, why does he say it that way? And why does like, he's happy that he doesn't have to think about that, but oh man, that's a big heavy thing. And you can see it like that's, mm-hmm. You can see an echo of Octavia Spencer's like grieving performance at the beginning of the movie in that moment when she realizes he turns into a mouse and mm-hmm. she's watching him come to this realization where she's more broken up about it than, it's like she lost him again. She fears that she's lost him again, but
mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. It's another reason why I think that this film is going to surprise people and how much it ultimately resonates with kids and gets watched a bunch and everything. I think it'll do very, very well. Just because, that it's interesting. There just seems to be the very things that made Zemeckis feel, a little traditional or a little old-fashioned, I think mm-hmm. are now going to be coming back into fashion. If you just look at, it's a film that kind of says, well, if you've lost your parents and you got to settle what's inside of you and work that out, and it doesn't matter how much time you have, and then there's, obviously the subtle implication there of a sort of union and a kind of afterlife. And so it's a very spiritual film. And I was thinking about how so many of those aspects we've talked about, and I'm sure we'll get to as we visit films like Contact. Mm-hmm. some of those spiritual aspects of the film felt, specifically Zemeckisian or Spielbergian, probably is how most people identify them. But it's interesting because I just watched the trailer for the new Pixar movie Soul, mm-hmm. which is coming out, and it's interesting to see the sort of hip Pixar kind of out there. They used to make movies about bugs and shit. Now making a movie literally about like souls descending from an afterlife into the material realm and then returning again, and all of that. Mm-hmm. It's the new Pixar movie that's coming out, and I was thinking about that in this. I was just thinking that we're kind of in this interesting place where Zemeckis's films, and I think this will also inform how people, and we're doing it right now with this podcast, reappraising films like Back to the Future, mm-hmm. when we did a lot, I won't touch on some of those same aspects of it, but it's like the things that Zemeckis was putting in there, why so many people think of him as, he's just a mechanist. He likes his toys and his shots and whatever. Is that the ideas he was putting into films and the idea, what he believed that made it in there, whether he was conscious of it or not, the idea that, this kind of belief in this interaction through this mirror, through this glass, with this spiritual realm, this exchange, and the idea that it's the place where all things come from and we're all going back again, that moral and metaphysical universe of Zemeckis, I think people are going to begin to notice it more when they watch his movies. In fact, just because it felt so oddly out of fashion, not with what people wanted, clearly his films were very successful, but out of what people were even looking to validate as qualities of good cinema, mm-hmm. in the sense that, like, looking back now, I mean, I'm hearing some filmmakers really going back and even reappraising. I've heard filmmakers who I had trouble getting them on board with John Ford before, mm-hmm. showing them, and now they're like friends of mine who I'm just trying to get on board with that sort of thing. And so much of the last 50 years or so, you don't hear that name very much anymore. Frank Capra, who's a much bigger direct influence, obviously, on Zemeckis. The people who engaged with this took seriously in their films the idea of an exchange between the kind of the material and the spiritual, I think were thought to be so light speed unfashionable, especially when Zemeckis was making his films. And again, I'm rambling at this point, but I think it's interesting that that exchange, like if you even talked about like the spiritual themes of a film, it would mean that there's something kind of goofy or silly, or let's just say overtly Christian about the film or something right. like that, you know, in the past. But now I don't know if that's the case in an interesting way. I feel like that now hit people, whether it doesn't matter if you live in, you know, Alabama or you live in, you know, Portland, Oregon, everyone meditates. People are kind of getting into a little bit more of a spiritual vibe. People are beginning to reckon with their own subconscious as a sort of that they need to sort of take on spiritual practices to sort of deal with that. People are rediscovering certain forms of spirituality. And when they do, I'm curious to see if there, and I guess maybe this podcast isn't happening, Richard, but people go and find greater depth in Zemeckis' films, because in a weird way, I don't know, I think that their time is nigh, Richard.
I would agree with that. Everybody's looking for new meaning just in their own lives and in the media that they consume.
I bet a bunch of people have watched Back to the Future several times in
during quarantine.
In
you think so?
Yeah, I think so.
I want to talk a little bit about some stuff that I found particularly Zemeckis, especially on second viewing. Like, we haven't really talked about Anne Hathaway's performance, which is so big. But the things I want to talk about specifically with it are just her rage moments, like the fact that she's picking up and throwing this podium that's exploding, which is, and and then that turns into her picking up and throwing the whole stage, which looks like they actually flipped over a stage. That didn't look like CG.
Yeah, that was great.
That looked awesome. And then she hurls the
like
bed.
That's what impresses us finally at this level. It's like they managed to flip over a whole small wooden stage and they didn't CGI it. Isn't it amazing?
It's not just the fact that like the shot of her throwing the stage and throwing the back of the bed, whatever, the headboard, throwing the headboard is those big, like crazy, like physical things feel very real, and land in close-ups, like Octavia Spencer's face is right in the when she throws the headboard, and Anne Hathaway's face is clearly right there as this pile of wood is breaking apart in the background, and that stuff was very, very pleasing to me to watch, and just seeing her as this kind of rage monster.
Yes. And that was interesting because it was sometimes the voice, it almost felt like a voice where she was anticipating them affecting it more. You know, like adding a monster voice, like I'll just do this right now, but they'll probably add some scary voice later.
And then dipping into Norwegian too.
I would have to watch it again. I enjoyed it. But I was kept trying to put my finger on it the whole time because it's like there's monster voice and Scandinavian and accent and all that kind of stuff.
German or Russian.
Yeah. And I liked her little toes. Toes.
Her weird toe that she's pirouetting on. And I thought of it early in the film when I was like, oh, that's going to get stuck in a mousetrap so so easily at the end of this movie. And so it was pleasing that the children mice then pushed the mouse.
Well, you know what, Richard, you got that one on me. I didn't see that one coming, and it was a delightful surprise when they mouse trapped her toes.
And sorry, my Alexa's going off and reminding me to drink water. But speaking of that mousetrap, touching toes.
Oh man, Richard, you're falling apart.
Oh, dude, this quarantine has got me.
You need Jeff Bezos to remind you
to get
water.
I need robots to remind me to hydrate. But that the mousetraps on her toes.
You should drink water, Richard. And buy something on Amazon.com.
I have been drinking water. When they mousetrap her toes, that's my favorite shot in the film, where the mouse, him holding the bottle of Formula 86, launches himself from the mousetrap in a huge arcing shot that I wish I could have seen in a theater with her screaming and it drops right
down. So very much a roller coaster, Monster House style shot.
Oh, man.
That was another thing where you're like, okay, clearly this was meant to be in a big theater, yeah. kind of goofy 3D shot and everything, and yeah.
Big, fun, rousing shot.
Yeah. No, actually, I really dug the kind of, what I was thinking of, she almost looked like something out of Mars Attacks, you know, and mm-hmm. With the, I love the extremity. Oh, no, there's also the fact that, and, you know, this will work for you or it won't, but there's also the fact that, like, with all the wigs and everything, that they it almost felt like a movie that was anticipating itself becoming a thing that drag queens will replicate in the future. And so it uh-huh. attempts to anticipate that in, it's like, it's a big, and it's almost, in a weird way, maybe that's why Anne Hathaway is going not just to 10, but to 12.
Yeah, he pushes past 11.
Pushes past 11 to 12. As I feel like on some level, she's trying to imagine the drag queen that will ultimately be doing a version of it, and she's trying to then outdo that drag queen, and that's how you get to 12. So, but I don't know. It's weird. I feel like I definitely want to watch again just to get another take on it, because there's certain moments, again, like we talked about the choice about the being disgusted about the money, mm-hmm. and so, I mean, here's another great choice to talk about. The iconic sequence, obviously the big set piece in the first film, is the meeting of the witches, mm-hmm. you know, all in the big conference room. And again, that it is impossible to probably overstate what a big impression that made on me when I was a kid.
Same.
Both in terms of obviously the crazy, crazy, crazy makeup, but also the contrast between the setting and that makeup. Just as much as, you know, the transformation in American Werewolf in London, which happens mm-hmm. in a brightly lit room with a needle drop playing underneath it, and, you know, seeing it as a kid, it just again pulls into high relief how the effects that are going on, and makes the unreality of them pushes it into a place where it has an immediacy, because it feels like a living room that anyone could be in, yada yada yada.
Right.
Same thing with the conference room. It is deliciously, in the first film, a generic conference room like one would see at the Radisson. I mean, it's pretty cool. But
most of us have been in a conference like that at some point in our lives.
It works for the same reason that, you know, a movie like Paranormal Activity works, because there's no production design in Paranormal Activity, so it just feels like the generic stucco house that every one of your 29-year-old friends just paid way too much money for and are, like, trying to pay off. And you're like, oh, there's a lot of fucking white walls in here. But that means that when you introduce this uncanny element into that context, all of a sudden it has this, like,
it exists in reality.
Immediacy.
Yeah, it
Whereas
exists
if they
in reality.
Had, yeah, if you had gone, like, you know how you could ruin Paranormal Activity? You go back in time, you give them $500 to production design that movie. It's like, here's $500. You should paint a wall or two. Then they would have, and they would have tried to make the house look slightly scary and would have made it just not look like a house anymore, and they would have fucked it up. So same thing with the witches thing, same thing with American Werewolf in London. So that, I really wanted to see how that sequence would turn out. And yes, it's a far more Southern Gothic mm-hmm. room, but it is still very much an old hotel conference room with a small raised stage. And what I like is that they actually spent a lot of time in there. They were not intercutting between other sequences. They were not going in. They did not blow through it or break that scene up into three other things. Zemeckis appreciated the fact that that set piece of the kid hiding, the witches are all in the room, we know the kid's in the room with them, you know, we know there's a bomb under the table, that not unlike that shot of the mouse in Anne Hathaway, it's so full of energy and so full of tension that he really, to a kind of exceptional degree, considering it's a big, splashy kids movie released by a studio, spends a lot of fucking time in just a set piece that they built, which I was mm-hmm. very, very, very happy with. And Anne Hathaway gets to do her whole thing and perform and float and whatever. And I enjoyed that aspect. I enjoyed especially the hands of the creatures. That is worth talking about. And the little tick, 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 tick. Oh, I didn't even think about that. I haven't thought about that since the movie. That was really good.
Yep.
And again, not unlike.
Very pleasing. Very pleasing.
And very subtle, because it, again, the idea of people snapping their fingers to clap evokes this idea of just sort of people who are a little bit hipper than now, mm-hmm. who are a little bit, you know, who are a little bit more coastal and a little bit less Alabama. All sorts of ideas are evoked there, which is very interesting. And again, it all stems from the fact that, you know, we just removed two fingers with CGI. So the aspects of the hands that we're seeing are real. And just that thing alone, I mean, how many kids, you know, how many fucking kids are going to walk out and they're going to fold their fingers back? God, I have no flexibility in my hands anymore. I used to be able to do that when I was a kid, fold my fingers back. They're going to fold their fingers back and they're going to pretend they have that weird, freaky-ass hand. And they had weird, freaky-ass feet, and she had weird, freaky-ass toes. And those toes, I think those toes severely disturbed my girlfriend. I think that every time the toes showed up, she was like, ugh.
They disturbed me.
I don't have an anti-foot thing. I have no problem with feet or toe things or whatever. Don't care. Didn't bother me. I thought it was just a cool choice. Like, that's how you know she's the witch. She gets two toes.
One toe. One on each foot. One on each foot.
The weirdest toe. It's definitely the weirdest toe. It's the second toe. It's not the big toe. It's not the little toe. It's clearly just that secondary toe. And that is a weird toe. It's the longest one for some people, including
me,
I think they
make it like a toe, though. The thumb toe. They make it kind of thumb toe-y.
They give it a little claw.
It's just ugly. It's an ugly toe.
Yeah. Ugh. They make the witches very unpleasant in this, and I like that a lot. Oh, well, like with Anne Hathaway, pulls a bug out of her scalp and all that.
And eats it.
Yeah, it's wonderful, yeah. Yeah, Stanley Tucci, by the way, it's worth mentioning, you know, there's a lot of Devil Wears Prada being evoked by the fact that, A, Stanley Tucci's in it acting opposite Anne Hathaway, and then Anne Hathaway is clearly dressed when she shows up in, like, this crazy, like, herringbone thing with a blonde wig that very much feels evocative of Meryl Streep in Devil Wears Prada, which brings us back to Death Becomes Her, and it ties the whole Witches Month together. Richard, do you see what I did there?
I did. It was very... you do it all the time. I love listening to it.
Wrapped it all up. Just free association. Now
wrapped it all up.
Now I am going to freestyle a rap.
Oh God, I'll start talking over this. Speaking of the lead into that that big crazy conference room sequence. One of the things I really did love when I felt it really being the children's horror movie, and it's the one time in the movie where I feel like it had the grandmother telling a fairy tale vibe that the first movie has, is when they're in bed together trying to go to sleep and it's raining and she's telling him all the things that he needs to look for about the witches to set up all the crows and stuff.
That was a cool sequence where it's all in the rain and everything.
It's like having like the CG rain drips show the big smile and show the claws, and Silvestri gets the musical gag with the kids' eyes opening as the lightning pops. Silvestri's score, by the way, is... Yeah. Really, really good. I've been listening to it kind of on a loop.
Yeah, and by the way, and just everything else from cool lighting effects or like lightning effects and atmosphere and all sorts of wonderful things are being deployed, which it goes without saying because it's a Zemeckis movie.
Of course, lightning.
So, yeah, of all that shit's happening. So all that shit's good too. We liked all that.
I also made a note of just the weird, going back to the chickenifying, Octavia Spencer's performance and the way that scene is cut and performed and edited.
Oh, yeah.
Just the lightning bolt crashes into close-up of him responding to her telling him that somebody was turned into a chicken, but actually seeing the weird Cronenberg body horror of somebody, of a girl turning into a chicken.
And not to mention the fact that, again... it's not just a CGI transition. There are deliberate cinematic choices being made to reveal it in pieces in one shot. So again, you have she starts out
with
it's
the
like
cockles.
A shot by the window. Yeah, noticing the thing by the window. Then she looks in the mirror again.
She has
ring
got
mirrors.
The beak.
You always got to have a mirror for the scene where the person transitions to the spiritual world, where she's annihilated. And so she then turns into a chicken face. Then the chicken face pecks the... I've only seen this movie once, by the way. Mm-hmm. And this is the potency of Zemeckis. The chicken then pecks on the table, which brings her eye to the table. And the camera continues that momentum all the way down to her chicken feet, which then are revealed as full-ass chicken feet. And then it shrinks. So here's why I like... To go back to the fart exploding transitions later, what I dig, not just about the witches, but to American Werewolf and everything, I love I love it when they would, you know, when they would do transitions. We even did it ourselves, Richard, when we made House of Straw, where you just progress the creature through different cuts, but the cuts are connected together cinematically such that
he rolls over. He rolls over and we get a new thing. Yeah.
Yeah, he rolls over and we get a new thing such that, you know, the movement between the cuts creates a sense of a connected reality, and then all you're doing is you're just swapping out iterations of the thing, as simple as, well, putting little, like, pointed ears on someone.
Super simple.
Super simple, you guys. really did not take much at all. No. I love those transitions. I love, especially with the Jim Henson stuff, you know, you're cutting around it. So what do you do in the age of CGI then? You know, well, Zemeckis loves, again, as we talked about in the Tales from the Crypt episode with the opening shot of On All Through the House and obviously Back to the Future and all the things, you know, he loves just revealing the information in pieces in a shot that progresses. And so he tells that story from the window to the floor, and then from the floor she then becomes, I guess, a chicken or something.
Then we cut outside.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, you could show a lot more morphing happening in camera, is my point. You could, but Zemeckis has, at least in this scene, an awareness that that morphing, that changing is not going to read as well as revealing her piece by piece. And in the transition between the window and the mirror, and the mirror and the table, and the table and the feet. And it's like, well, why would you hide those transitions? They're we know they're computers. You can really lean into them. You can go really close and show the feathers coming out of her skin and all that kind of stuff. Again, all of that stuff just sort of diminishes that sense of it actually taking place, because now we're not using the CGI to literally animate. I mean, there's definitely some of that going on in her head. I'm not saying this is not black and white, but we're not using the CGI to actually show cellular transformation or whatever literalized version of it is. It's merely to mask the transitions that could have otherwise be cleverly achieved with, even if you were to. It's like the great practical effects transition in one shot that you couldn't do in such a subtle form were it not for CGI.
And you're talking about it's making individual moments out of the transformation thing, as opposed to just be this continuous thing. You can sit and be like, oh, it's the things hanging from her chin. Oh, it's the beak. Oh,
yeah! It clearly makes choices on the textual level. It makes choices when writing. It makes choices it makes choices at the beginning of the scene. To this is the sequence of things that will reveal her to be a chicken, and here's how it will take it from the top of her body all the way down to her feet in a sequence. Because of course, chicken feet are a great thing to reveal chicken feet. And again, it's so simple. You know, it's hard to talk. It sounds silly to praise it, and yet we have to praise it because there's a lot of CGI transitions and shit now. And what happens? Mm-hmm. Well, the camera stays very still for the computers, and then we watch a person or one CGI golem turn into another CGI golem with lots of morphing and jiggly skin that looks like jello and horns popping out that look like vines and all sorts of shit. And I don't know. It's just, it was one of those delightful moments where, yeah, it's chock full of CGI. Yeah, it's a girl turning into a chicken. Yeah, it's silly. But it's still good movie making going on at work at the same time. That now, having watched the movie once, not entirely sober, a couple days ago, I can remember that beat very, very, very clearly, and I want to see it again.
I can say that, like, this for me was a check your baggage at the door kind of thing and let the movie do what it's doing. And once you do that, like, once I did that, like, oh man, it was a much, much better experience. And it felt like a much better movie. And
I will tell you what you were responding to, Richard. I will reach inside your mind. You actually said it out loud. It's just very obvious, but it's just that idea that you, as you watch the movie, you perceive that, damn it, this is going to be a movie where other people are going to take shots at Bobby.
I'm going to have to defend this.
Yes, I'm going to have to defend this. But the thing is, we don't have to defend it, Richard, because
it defends itself.
Because you know who's in the right? Bobby Z. Bobby Z is in the right. And the reason Bobby Z is in the right is because he, not unlike Frank Capra before him, with It's a Wonderful Life, I don't know why I'm bringing that in, it has nothing to do.
He
knows that this film will grow in its estimation in time. And he's making films for... I can't continue this way. You know what I'm saying, though.
I do. Let me finish your thought for you.
I was trying to sound something. I was trying to go real, like, big with it, Richard, at the end, but I couldn't pull it off.
Let me finish it for you. And maybe this isn't exactly where you're going, but thinking of Kinnan's...
Liberty Films.
Thinking of Kinnan and Allison's kids seeing this. They're like 5, 6, and 7, 8 right now, and they thought it was terrifying, and they really loved the movie. In very much the same way that I believe that we interacted with the 90s version. And you kind of have hinted at this before. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, we have a whole bunch of adults watching this movie and trying to determine its timeliness and its quality, when in fact, like, the things that he's doing work for the target audience. It's connecting with the people the movie is made for, and that's where it will live, I think, is in the minds of the 6-year-olds, the 8-year-olds, the 12-year-olds who watch this and see the Fright Night face for the first time and see the fart transformations, and people disappearing and empty clothes flying, because those are iconic images. Those are very iconic images. So I think that'll stick with people. And you're saying, that is what will cause its estimation to grow in time.
You know, I'm absolutely with you.
What are your final parting thoughts? Like, I think I don't know why anybody would listen to us talk for this about this movie for this long without having watched it for themselves.
I know what my parting thoughts are. My parting thoughts are this. It's interesting to have come to this as a midpoint movie in this series, because we are watching The Witches having not recently revisited really anything past Roger Rabbit, which is where we've made it, and I've deliberately avoided revisiting, you know, anything later than
until
that.
We
so really
get to
all
it.
Of the a lot of the CGI laden stuff that comes later. And there's already stuff in this movie that has nothing to do with the CGI that I'm very curious to re-examine once we see the rest of those films. And so I have a feeling that more commentary on The Witches is going to come, but now that commentary for The Witches can be sort of sown through the remainder of our episodes. So if you want to see our evolution on our thoughts on The Witches, continue to watch, and I'll just seed it with one example. If you noticed the the sign for the Witches conference, it's ostensibly a humanitarian group in both films, mm-hmm. and it's ironically the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Mm-hmm. And in this film, it is the sign, just a vinyl sign as one would see in the period, hung up outside of a conference room, is then surrounded on all sides by tiny mannequins of children, you know, to represent. Yep. And something about them holding the children as mannequins, implying evil, and knowing the relationship that Zemeckis has with people accused of the doll-like movies, and specifically the Welcome to Marwen, which I have not seen yet.
Me neither. I'm excited to watch it.
I'm excited to see, yeah. And I'm very curious, because honestly, I've spent, and this is the point, because we haven't really watched any of those films recently, and I still haven't seen Welcome to Marwen, I haven't spent a lot of time trying to process the relationship between sort of, I guess, what is these golems, whatever they are, the Barbie dolls in Marwen, or these mannequins, or even if there's any relationship of substance between that and all of the CGI movies, the performance capture movies. But I am very curious, and we need to think about this. When we make it to the end, Richard, we need to revisit those creepy-ass mannequins, and I'm going to bet you we're gonna have a lot more to say about those mannequins after we watch.
I agree. I'm really excited to revisit this again with Beowulf and Christmas Carol and Welcome to Marwen.
I forgot we have to watch. We're going to watch Beowulf again. I say have to. I'm excited to watch Beowulf again.
Yeah, I think that it's going to... I'm hoping, and I'm fairly confident that it's going to provide a different color to what this movie is, certainly in context of his career.
Word.
Especially Marwen, which is supposed to be a colossal misfire in just about every respects, which I That's don't right. entirely believe for a lot of the reasons that you've talked about, Kyle. But next, I guess, Tales from the Crypt is going to come out after this, and then we're on to Back to the Future 2 and 3.
Yeah, Richard, I have an idea. I have an idea for another podcast we should do. I've hit you up with this before. Bill Paxton. We just do all the films of Bill Paxton. As Texans, I think it's our job to honor Bill Paxton. So you sound off, fans. If you want to see us talk about the films of Bill Paxton, you throw it out there.
My thought was, Kyle, that we should do something called Formative Fantasy, which is The Witches and Time Bandits and Legend.
Ooh.
And all of the kind of things that we associate with fantasy as children. Labyrinth,
yes.
Dark Crystal, and just kind of doing a deep dive into all that
Word.
Stuff. That's my idea.
But just think about the Bill Paxton podcast. You'd watch all the early Paxton. So you would have to get Terminator in there. You know, you'd have to get Near Dark in there. But then later on, you're watching Frailty. You're watching Titanic. You're watching all
Simple
the Cameron
Plan
stuff.
A Simple Plan.
Yeah, a Simple Plan. Absolutely, you're watching A Simple Plan with goddamn Billy Bob Thornton. He's like, I've never even kissed a girl, and I'm just like, oh, Dad, that sucks. I didn't know there were people like that. Now I'm a kid, and I'm watching this movie with my dad. He read the book Simple Plan. He was really excited to see the movie. And then we saw it, and I'm like, God damn, this is harsh. And Sam Raimi, Simple Plan, right?
Sam Raimi, Simple Plan.
Sam Raimi.
Yeah, that's how I know.
Yep. Yeah, so much good Paxton. All of Big Love. I think we could skip Big Love. I'm not saying it depends. I actually watched the first season of Big Love back in the day. I don't know why we're talking about Bill Paxton. I've just had Bill Paxton on the brain lately. Oh, he came up, didn't he, when we did the last Tales from the Crypt podcast. We were debating whether or not Bill Paxton was the voice on the phone. That's how he's threaded into this series. So I don't know. There's a lot of magical energy around Bill Paxton. I have a feeling he was a spiritual warrior. We'll have to explore.
Well, definitely with Frailty. Absolutely spiritual warrior.
Oh yeah. Oh fuck yeah. God. He directed Frailty, right?
Yep.
Fuck yeah. I don't know, man.
There's a lot there.
So you know what else Bill Paxton was in the latter day of his career? It's The Circle, that movie. It was a very bad. This is not a good movie. I was kind of using it as a joke. I don't know. I pulled a bunch of Circle footage for something I was cutting at some point, and Bill Paxton plays Hermione's sick dad while she goes to work for evil Tom Hanks at the evil Apple Company in that movie.
Let's wrap up, Kyle. Thank you for talking through this with me. It was wonderful to see a new movie that neither of us had any connection to, and to. Yeah. Kind of get into the weirdness of
it.
It was fun.
It was fun. Hopefully people will respond to us arguing about new movies instead of revisiting old ones. So there you go.
Yeah. It's like the one time we'll get a chance to do this, unless for whatever reason this podcast extends all the way until his Pinocchio movie gets made.
Well, there will be no new Bill Paxton movies. So.
Well, yes. Rest in peace.
All
right. Next up, hopefully for us to record Back to the Future 2 and then Back to the Future 3. And then that's the thing. Can't wait to get into those.
Absolutely, dude. This was fun. I'm really glad we got a chance to do this because this was a good movie. And I don't know. I just dug watching both films. I would not have watched both films back to back if it had not been for this podcast. And I did. And I love the hell out of it.
It was an important thing to do for context.
All right,
Later, buttheads.